Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. United States Vice President Mike Pence told members of NATO Saturday at the Munich Security Conference that the U.S. is fully committed to the bloc. Pence also reinforced a U.S. position that some NATO members must step up and honor their financial obligations.
Let me be clear on this point. The President of the United States expects our allies to keep their word, to fulfill this commitment, and for most, that means the time has come to do more.
NATO Secretary General added the alliance means more than contributing money.
Europeans cannot ask the United States to commit to Europe's defense if they are not willing to commit more themselves. Because when our neighbors are more stable, we are more secure. All allies must speed up their efforts to meet the target of spending 2% of GDP on defense.
Jens Stoltenberg. President Trump took to Twitter Saturday morning to take another shot at reporters ahead of his planned campaign-style rally Saturday afternoon in Florida. A White House spokeswoman told Reuters this week that Mr. Trump planned the event partly because he doesn't think his message is always treated fairly in the news, and Trump can deliver his own message very effectively, her words now, by taking the stage and talking to the American people. His weekend road trip began on Friday at the Boeing aircraft facility in South Carolina, where he delivered a pep talk to workers and viewed the new Boeing Dreamliner airplane. And the oldest Muslim organization in the U.S. held its annual meeting with lawmakers. The Ahmadiyya Muslim community emphasized a new message that most Muslims are peaceful. This is VOA News. The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, is calling for the safe, unconditional release of two staff members abducted in northern Afghanistan early this month, allegedly by the Islamic State militants. They were abducted during a convoy transporting food for livestock of the poverty-stricken farmers in the region when they were ambushed. The charity has since suspended its humanitarian operations across the country, where millions of people are in urgent need of aid because of the infestation, or intensification, that is, of the Taliban-led insurgency. United Nations aid agencies are warning they have a two-month window of opportunity in drought-stricken Somalia in which to increase emergency assistance for millions of people. Lisa Schlein has our story from the UN headquarters in Geneva.
The United Nations estimates half of Somalia's population, or 6.2 million people, are threatened by the drought which is spreading from the hard-hit northern regions. Over the past week, representatives of the World Food Program and the UN Children's Fund visited some of the worst affected areas in the northern Puntland region. They describe scenes of utter devastation where people have reached the limit of their abilities to cope. Nearly 260,000 people, half of them children under five, died during the famine in Somalia between 2010 and 2012. UNICEF projects the number of severely malnourished children in Somalia could reach 270,000 over the coming months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New Zealand and Australia have reaffirmed their commitment to strengthen bilateral ties when the two countries' prime ministers met in Queenstown. Both Bill English, the New Zealand Prime Minister, and Malcolm Turnbull, the Australian Prime Minister, are reaffirming their support of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, despite the United States' withdrawal from the agreement. Hear now from Prime Minister Turnbull.
The new American administration pulled out of the TPP, but will continue to open up, working together, recognising our shared interests are in opening up more economic opportunities.
Prime Minister English said both he and Mr. Turnbull have been in touch with their TPP partners to figure out ways to move forward without the U.S. participation. The United States Senate has confirmed President Trump's pick to run the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, over the objections of environmentalists who are worried that he will roll back the agency's enforcement efforts. Scott Pruitt said he will reform and modernize the EPA. For additional news, we invite you to join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Applauded the proclamation because we have been calling and mounting a number of campaigns around the date for the election to be released.
Sierra Leonean groups challenge the National Electoral Commission over the date for next year's presidential election.
We petitioned the speaker as we sought to be heard by the Legislative Assembly because others have systematically refused to listen to the voice of the victims.
Burundian civil society groups petition the East African Legislative Assembly to open a forum to hear from victims of the Burundian crisis.
Polo is expensive. It really is. It's because of the number of horses that we have and the quality of horse flesh that we have and the time that we take to prepare our horses, and that's where the big cost lies, you know.
And polo playing gains traction in South Africa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Two Sierra Leonean opposition political parties and the National Election Watch, a group representing civil society groups, are challenging the March 7, 2018 date set by the National Electoral Commission for the country's next presidential election. The groups contend that the date contravenes the constitution. Marcela Samba Sisi, chairperson for the National Election Watch, told me the poll date falls outside the constitutional limit of 90 days allowed for an election after the term of the incumbent president expires.
Inasmuch as we applauded the proclamation, because we have been calling and mounting a number of campaigns around the date for the election to be released. So since the 28th of November, we have speculated that since the announcement is coming out, it should come out in February. If it's not announced within a given time, we might probably run late. And we want the Electoral Commission that we are in for problems if we fail to announce election day. So one of the things that came out clearly is that once the local council election has been previously deferred, and the parliamentary elections for March 7th, 2018, we are still stable and well in place according to the legal framework of Sierra Leone. Unfortunately, the presidential elections fall short and could not match what is stated both in the Sierra Leone Constitution and equally so the Public Elections Act of 2012.
Now, you said the presidential election, as they have set that date by the National Electoral Commission, sharply contravenes that of the Constitution. Why do you think so? And have you petitioned the Electoral Commission to change the date to conform to that of the Constitution?
In fact, that's exactly what you called it. Because the law says that the in Section 43, Section 3B of the Public Order Act, it says, and I want to quote that verbatim, in any other case, the Electoral Commission may, in the proclamation referred to in subsection 2, fix the actual date of the election. The date must not be earlier than 60 days and not later than 60 days before the date appointed for voting. But the Constitution gave allowances after the 5 years. The President could go another 30 days or in compelling situations, plus 60 days, which in totality is 90 days. If we count backwards, the actual date for the election should be 23rd February 2018. So in that light, since the Constitution mandates to the National Electoral Commission to announce presidential dates in consultation with the President, we as National Elections Watch is actually posing a question to make, that's the National Electoral Commission, to tell us the reason for the deferment of presidential election day beyond the stipulated time frame asked by the Constitution of Sierra Leone 1991 and equally so Section 43 of the Public Elections Act
Wouldn't a decision from the court be more justified to really explain this constitutional provision, since obviously there's a divide between your stance and that of the Electoral Commission or the National Electoral Commission that set the date for the presidential election?
I totally agree with you. In fact, one of the things in our press release I'm called for, because the Council Organization, the National Election Service, is the Bar Association of Sierra Leone. What we said to them is that they need to step up and take responsibility as part of their mandate to advise the public on a legal, especially one that is as pertinent as elections.
Marcela Sambasese is the chairperson for the National Election Watch, a Sierra Leonean civil society group. She spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. A group of Burundian civil society has petitioned the East African Legislative Assembly. The group urged the Legislative Assembly to organize a forum to hear from the victims of the Burundian crisis. This after the group said they were sidelined from participating in the on-again, off-again Burundian dialogue aimed to resolve the crisis. To learn more about the petition, I reached a prominent member of the petitioners, Vital Nshimirimana, leader of the group Forum for the Strengthening of Civil Society.
We petitioned YALA yesterday on 17, and we petitioned the speaker as we sought to be heard by the Legislative Assembly because others have systematically refused to listen to the voice of the victims.
Are you saying that all civil society groups have not been invited by mediators as part of the Burundi dialogue to resolve the crisis in Burundi?
Well, there is no two or three civil society groups. There is one and a unique following the universal standards. In civil society, that does not speak for the tortured, the killed, the abducted is not a civil society. We are the one who are struggling for the respect of the constitution, the legality, and human rights and the civic space. Now we are seeing that the East African community is systematically ignoring our voice, and we are the one talking, actually caring about the victim.
Vital, when you petitioned the Speaker of the East African Legislative Assembly, have you heard back from them? And what kind of hearing do you anticipate?
Well, the Speaker is the President of the East African Legislative Assembly. The East African Legislative Assembly is the representative of the East African citizens, and it has the duty to actually look at the well-being of all the citizens. And as such, it has the obligation to hear and to take into account on claims raised by citizens whenever there is a problem in any of the six partner states. And then now the speaker has the duty to program a hearing where people will testify on ongoing human rights and the humanitarian crisis.
Some people say your petition to IALA is an indication that you don't have confidence in the mediation efforts by former Tanzania President Benjamin Mkapa. And they are asking why you wouldn't direct your petition to him. So you will be invited. Your group and other groups will be invited to be part of the Burundi dialogue. Why haven't you done so?
We don't trust in the EAC-appointed facilitator, President Mkapa, because when he stated in December that all the victims that are prosecuted by the de facto regime in Bujumbura should be arrested, and when he asserted that Burundi government could amend the constitution. So we thought that this man has resigned
And for several times, we have written to the facilitator, but we have never been received. And right now, there is peace talks in Arusha, but civil society is never invited.
What will a hearing on Burundi by IALA do to help the victims of the Burundi crisis? How will this help them?
The IALA is the only organ of the EAC which has been very active and very lucid in actually trying to understand what is happening in Burundi. I recall that a member of the IALA, a representative of Burundi, Mrs. Hafsa Mot, was assassinated back in July. And the IALA can afford civil society and the other interested groups the space to talk, to inform other citizens of the community, the ESC, and the worldwide.
Vital Nshimirimana is the leader of the Burundian Group Forum for the Strengthening of Civil Society. He spoke with me from somewhere in Belgium. Zimbabwean First Lady Grace Mugabe says her husband is so popular that millions of people will vote for him even if he dies before the presidential election. The ruling ZANU-PF party is fielding Robert Mugabe as its presidential candidate. Mr. Mugabe, who has led Zimbabwe since independence in 1980, is the world's oldest leader. For reaction, Blessing Zulu from VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7 spoke with Obet Gutu, spokesperson of the opposition movement for democratic change formation led by Morgan Changarai.
It is really something that doesn't come to us as a surprise at all, because, as you know, Grace Mugabe is, whatever she says, it's actually reflective of the mood within the First Family household. And it also gives us an insight, maybe even into the state of health of President Robert Mugabe himself. It is actually something very telling. And as the MDC, we see that as a manifestation of a woman who is very worried about the health condition of her husband. Mr. Mugabe is not a young man. He's 93 in the next few days. He is frail. And this is why you find that he's hardly coming out in the public of late ever since he came back from his extended holiday in the Far East. And this is clearly a woman who is panicking, a woman who is trying to strike fear into the hearts of Zimbabweans. But unfortunately for her, she will not succeed. Zimbabweans appreciate that Mr. Mugabe has had his time, and they appreciate that it is not a matter of whether, but just a matter of when Mr. Mugabe is going to vacate State House.
Some political analysts are saying the ruling party is already preparing for the 2018 elections, and Mrs. Mugabe is already on the campaign trail. Is this what you saw from the rally?
Yeah, that rally, from our own analysis, really is a mixed bag. One, I would not want to interpret it as a campaign rally. To me, it is just a public outcry by a very distressed and stressed woman who, because she lives with President Mugabe, she appreciates the state of his health, and she is very worried. So it is not so much of a campaign rally. It is more of a desperate cry and the plea of a woman who sees that her husband's days in office are numbered. And she's trying to say, okay, this man, whether or not he's alive, you are going to vote for him. Because she knows that, obviously, no sane person is going to believe her when she says they are going to vote for a cop. It is, to me, a cry for help, a cry for assistance, a cry for empathy, more than, as would put it, more than is it a campaign rally. She's just out there crying out in the public for sympathy. But unfortunately, the people of Zimbabwe don't sympathize with her. If anything, they see her as being at the epicenter of their suffering.
And lastly, she was also talking about factionalism in the ruling party. Are you at all surprised by this talk, judging from the fact that the ruling party has expelled over 100 members over the past years for allegedly trying to topple Mr. Mugabe?
Not at all. We are not surprised, because it's a public secret that ZANU-PF is so factionalized that it is almost like at least three political parties in one: the Robert Mugabe faction, the so-called G40 faction, the so-called Tim Lacoste faction. What you are simply saying was to publicly admit that there is factionalism. But this is no longer news for us Zimbabweans, for the people of Zimbabwe. Because each and every day there are reports of factional fighting within ZANU. Even in their own ZANU-PF-controlled media, ZBC TV, ZBC Radio, these factional fights are playing out. So what he's simply doing, I believe, is just to publicly acknowledge that there is factionalism. But let me emphasize to say it is not news anymore. Everyone in Zimbabwe, and even outside Zimbabwe, anyone who cares to know about the recent political events in Zimbabwe knows that ZANU-PF is in the political departure lounge, and that factionalism is one of the last nails on the coffin of ZANU-PF.
Obet Ogutu is the spokesperson of the Zimbabwean Opposition Movement for Democratic Change Formation, led by Morgan Tsvangirai. He spoke with Blessing Zulu from the capital, Harare. Meanwhile, a nationwide industrial action by Zimbabwean doctors has entered a fourth day, plunging the country's health sector into a major crisis. Despite Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe's government threatening to fire striking doctors, government gynecologists and obstetricians on Friday also downed tools in solidarity with the striking doctors. Ambrose Sibindi is vice chairman of the Zimbabwean Congress of Trade Unions. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Bulawayo for an update on the situation.
Well, it's clear that the doctors have gone on strike, I think, from yesterday. And today we understand even the senior doctors have also joined to the strike. But the bottom line is very clear. The doctors are clear on their demand. I think we are all aware of the monies that they are taking from the government. And the government has always been promising them to give them to increase their monies, but it's not. As a result, the doctor itself is down tools. And we clearly understand that even some other hospitals, some of the sections have been closed. The situation is really very bad. It is our hope and belief that the government must come in quickly and intervene by making sure that it talks to the doctors and really give the doctors what they really want or meet them somewhere, because that's the bottom line.
I see. Do you know why this action had to be taken right now? Any particular reason?
Well, I think we're all aware that the doctors have been put back in the government for a long time and they've been promised. And mind you, this is not the first time that the doctors have gone on strike. They've done that before and they've been promised that their issues will be addressed, but they're not being addressed. So I think enough is enough. That's why the doctors have gone on strike. And more so, we need to understand that the job that they are doing is very sensitive. They've got families to look after, and when you are at work and when you know that something's not going right in your family, there is no food, children are not even at school, they are being fed food, you don't really concentrate on your job, it becomes very dangerous to patients. So I think it's high time that the doctors took this action so that it can be registered once and for all, so that when they go back to work, they really focus on their jobs. Mind you, they are dealing with life. Make sure that all that they do, they save lives.
I see. But we understand the government has made threats to fire the striking doctors. Do you think that threat will work?
Well, it's very unfortunate that when issues are brought up, the government decides to go on threats. A serious government should engage the doctors and hear their concerns and possibly try and meet them somewhere, because threats will not work. Mind you, when you talk about threats, you are really, the government is undermining their own citizens, because people who get sick, they are the citizens. So if you threaten the doctor and the doctor will keep away, what will happen to the citizens? It's a very unfortunate situation. In such a situation, we need that the government and the doctors must come together, they dialogue and come up with a compromise, then they move forward. Threats will not work in this particular case.
And finally, how do you see this impasse ending? How this standoff do you think will end? Will the government cave in and meet the demands of the doctors?
Well, in life, we live by being positive. It is our hope that the government will this time pay an ear and do something about it, because you cannot continue ignoring an issue, because even if it's not today, it will resurface tomorrow. So definitely the government must just listen and do something about it, and this thing must be solved once and for all.
Ambrose Sibindi is the vice chairman of the Zimbabwean Congress of Trade Unions. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Bulawayo. Horse riding isn't new to southern Africans. Many in countries like Lesotho, South Africa, and Zimbabwe ride in their villages or patrol the farms they work on horseback. But polo is a pursuit generally played by rich elites across the world and mostly by super wealthy whites. However, in South Africa, this is changing. the sport attracting growing numbers of black Africans who are shattering the stereotypes. For VOA, Daring Taylor reports in the second part of a series on fringe sports gaining support in South Africa.
The one thing I like about these South African players, they play a really good classic four-man polo. They know where
TV commentary from a South Africa versus England polo match. The game's played on a very big field. Two teams, each with four players, try to outmaneuver one another on horseback. With long wooden mallets, they try to score more goals than their opponents by hitting a small plastic ball through goalposts.
Polo is expensive. It really is. It's because of the number of horses that we have and the quality of horse flesh that we have and the time that we take to prepare our horses, and that's where the big cost lies, you know.
Craig James is polo manager at the Inanda Club in Johannesburg. He says in the past, only South Africa's white elite could afford to play the game.
In South Africa, a lot of the polo players were from polo playing families, so farmers traditionally. And if you weren't born into a polo family, it's unlikely that you would have been exposed to polo or had the opportunity to play.
But by allowing far less privileged people to use his club's horses and equipment, James is changing the sport's image. Lakheden Singor leads horses to a field to train them. He's part of a new, albeit small, wave of black polo players in South Africa. He's a former groom at the Inanda Club. Nsingo was raised on a farm near Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
I love horses because I grew up with horses. And then I started riding horses when I was 9. And now my level of experience riding is 15 years riding horses.
Nsingo's knowledge and love of horses made him ideal for James's polo development program. Nsingo puts a bridle on a horse and prepares to ride. He's a tall, slender man. He wears a helmet covered in camouflage print, skin-tight tan pants, and long, shiny brown leather boots. Because of men like Nsingo, says James, there's now black muscle on South Africa's formerly lily-white polo fields.
Going forward, how the perception's changing is by involving guys like Lucky. Lucky is really critical to the success of my operation here at the Inanda Club. Without him, I couldn't do it. He's got some children that he's coaching, so he functions as my assistant coach.
Nsingor guides horses on a gallop around a dirt track. He says up until about a year ago, all he knew about polo was that it was a Ralph Lauren clothing label. Until James taught him the game that's now his passion.
I had someone teach me very good to have some rules and stuff like that, like Craig. How we stick with the man, how we play, how he goes, how this and this. So I'm very happy about it.
Nsingo says his relatives and friends often don't know what to say when he tells them he's a polo player.
You know, they don't know what he is, but they're really excited because polo is all over the world.
As an agitated horse kicks a stable door for food before crunching a carrot, Nsingo explains he's now teaching the next generation of African polo players.
I've got some young ones coming up, some young juniors, so I'm looking forward to teach them to have some skills. I hope to have more teaching the young ones to grow up and show us the skills.
James describes Nsingo and his pupils as polo pioneers.
The transformation is kind of happening where we're showcasing more of these guys that are coming from a bit more humble beginnings. And also through the school initiative, we're now making polo accessible because you no longer have to own 5 or 6 horses just to get started. You could come to Inanda and learn how to play rather than having to buy the whole setup and then...
His dream is for polo to be a game played by many black Africans, not just the current few. But for that, James needs more quality, expensive horses.
And that is a limiting factor at the moment, which we are slowly but surely overcoming. And, you know, we're finding sponsors that are getting behind these initiatives and saying, look, let's get behind a guy and push him all the way to the top and see how far he can go.
In the near future, James wants his trainees to compete internationally, including at the Polo World Cup. He's convinced this will happen, especially if South Africa's new elite offers support.
I think if you look at the wealthy in this country now, a lot of these guys are black guys. Very, very good businessmen, leaders of the industry. Having more black players playing will involve more of these guys.
He also wants to get poor kids off the streets and onto polo horses while educating them academically at the same time.
They may not become professional polo players. I'm fine with that. But if we've bettered their life and they meet someone through polo in the industry, which puts them in some fancy corporate job one day, you know, that's the ultimate goal.
For now, it's only a few men like Nsingo who are kick-starting Africa's polo revolution. But the so-called sport of kings may eventually see new, unexpected faces ascending the throne. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Thank you. Caroline, yeah. Baby, fast forward, eh. Me love the way you run, yeah. So, baby, fast forward, eh. Me love the way you run. Baby, fast forward, eh. Now rewind, yeah. Fast forward, eh. Me love the way you run, yeah. Baby, fast forward, eh. Me love the way you run, run. Baby, fast forward, eh.
Sí, 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 sí Sele, Napoli, Tate, Giali, Funa.
stay fresh, I'm a day one low. I'm a day one low. Keke de mo tingo. Aboki wa sare. Mo dagba mo tun shawo. Owo ti de no wo sese. Oje si olode. I'm a day olode. Odo mo de olode. I'll be getting the Benjamin, yeah. Diamonds all over me, yeah. Plenty blessing, they follow me, yeah. Every day we, yeah, yeah, yeah. Every day we party, come. Each other they fly, 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 yeah. He can make me happy, come. Take care of my tingo, oh, oh. Boki wa sage, oh. Oda ka mo tun shawo, shawo. Oh, ti de no wo, she, she. Oje si olo, ode, ode. Omode, ode. Odomode, olo.
That time when I hit the street, I be chasing this money. Fire upon my enemy.
They be the big old summer now. They be the big old summer now. And they go the big old summer now. They be the big old summer now.
One you go so, I'm a tower lake, I know. Talodi go so, I think they get a voting power.
You can get a voting go. Aboki wa sare, Oda ka mo tun shawo.
Oh,
maske ungahambu melekaya ingaske ubusuku bungadluli ongondi sibambile isandla sakho ungowami ngowakho dani wami divuna wena ekaleni kwam itela mundiphethe ngayo izolo ndizithathile isigqibo
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the dream of cats is all mice. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
The United States Constitution, the law of the land since its ratification in 1789, established a national government, provided a structure for the relationship between the central government and the states, and limited the government's power by instituting a separation of powers, as well as a system of checks and balances. The framers of the Constitution also made provisions that allowed for it to be changed or amended to reflect changes within society itself. To protect individual rights and guarantee ratification of the Constitution, 10 amendments were added to the document before it was even ratified. These are collectively named the Bill of Rights. Of these, the First Amendment may arguably be the most important. It stipulates that every citizen has the right to practice his or her own religion without government interference, that they have the right to express their own opinion without fear of government suppression or reprisal, that citizens may assemble in a group without government interference, that they may protest unfair treatment by the government and then petition to address those injustices, and that the press is free to write about controversial topics without the threat of government censorship. The first clause of the First Amendment is meant to promote religious freedom by prohibiting the government from imposing a national religion. But it also means that no religious sect may use the government or its assets at any level to promote itself or to force its tenets on those who do not observe that particular set of beliefs. The freedom to speak or publish one's opinion prevents government censorship, but it also puts the onus of responsibility for one's actions on the individual. This means that if one spreads malicious lies or incites violence, he or she will be held responsible for the consequences. Likewise, the right to assembly does not mean one is free to riot. The First Amendment prevents the government from limiting the freedom of expression, and therefore the freedom of thought and the dissemination of ideas. It is indeed the law that guarantees individual freedom. In the words of mid-20th century Supreme Court Justice William Douglas, restriction of free thought and free speech is the most dangerous of all subversions. It is the one un-American act that could most easily defeat us.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.